I think passion is carries a lot of weight, and almost more weight than it should, because it can kind of freak people out, and it's kind of set up this finality to it that can be really intimidating.
Welcome to the Future Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Doe, and joining me as always is the lovely Greg Gunn.
Lovely. Interesting. Interesting choice there. But you know what? I'll take it. So what's going on today?
Today we're going to be talking to Philip Van Dusen. He's got an intriguing career because, much like myself, he's lived most of his life as a creative professional, and then he got into creating content for YouTube. So there's a lot of synergy between the things that we're both doing.
Speaking of synergy between you two, I think, Chris, if you were to grow a little soul patch on your chin, you guys would look a lot alike.
I could draw one in, Greg. Won't be as thick as his.
That should be our Instagram filter for the future that we make.
If Colonel Sanders had a cousin that was hip and into design and lost a lot of weight, I think that would describe what Philip Van Dusen looks like.
So, kindred spirits already.
Yes.
So what did you guys talk about?
Well, I wanted to learn about this person behind the camera. The person that I know is what most of us know, which is a person who hosts a really informative channel on YouTube where he talks about design. He's probably most well known for his predictions on what's trending and what's not trending. And so those are his most popular videos. And to be honest, I've only been aware of him through the YouTube channel, so I was pleasantly surprised to learn about his storied career and the different things that he's done in his life. So it gave a lot more depth and nuance to who he is and why everybody should tune in.
Very cool. I'm excited to listen.
Great. Well, I hope you enjoy this episode with Philip Van Dusen. Philip, thank you for coming on the show. And for people who don't know about you, can you give us the really quick intro?
I'm Philip Van Dusen, and I'm a principal of Verhal Brand Design, which is a consultancy. We specialize in brand strategy, marketing, and design for small to medium-sized businesses and entrepreneurs.
Are you a classically trained designer?
I am not. I am a classically trained painter.
Wow.
I have my master's in painting. I used to teach painting back in the day.
So how did you go from painting to doing design and brand strategy?
I took I like to call it a career web rather than a career ladder. lots of side jogs, but they all made each other stronger. And I started off as a painter, as I said, was teaching university for a little bit. And then I came back from teaching in the south of France and started my own t-shirt company with the monotypes that I had been producing when I was teaching. And this was before the internet, so that dates me. And I walked the island of Manhattan with my little t-shirt sample case, selling my stuff in street fairs in Manhattan and stuff like that. Eventually, over a period of time, realized that I didn't really like sales that much, and I loved doing the design work. So I went to work for one of my competitors, about a $5 million t-shirt company that was in Dumbo, Brooklyn, back when Dumbo did not have a West Elm. I worked there for about 4 or 5 years, and I went from designer to senior designer to creative director very quickly, and I realized very quickly that being a creative director was a lot like teaching, except you got paid more money and you weren't out of work every 9 months. So
so it's nothing like teaching. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
This is very good. Well, I got a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
You're in New York. How are you sustaining yourself selling t-shirts? This sounds like how do you make ends meet?
Yeah, I was actually working at a frame shop in the West Village at the same time. And then I started doing well enough that I stopped working in the frame shop. But that's also right about the time that the first Mac started to make its appearance in terms of really being a workable design machine. That's when I went to work for this other t-shirt company.
I see. Ooh, man, you are like an early kind of digital artist if you're talking about the first Mac. I'm going to throw out a date here, and you don't have to confirm nor deny the date is real or not. Are we talking like 85-ish, like late 80s?
We're talking like very, very early 90s, like 90, 91. Okay.
And is this the beige all-in-one Macintosh that we're talking about?
Yeah. Well,
okay, the monochrome monitor, the 512K.
Yeah. The first one.
I remember those days. So and I'm dating myself too.
You know, I learned, actually, I think the first one, the first Mac I had, I rented. And I rented it from a shop in Manhattan. It was a Quadra 700 or maybe the one before that. I think the first one I bought was a Quadra 700. But it had like, you know, a 200 or 175 megabyte hard drive in it. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, how powerful it was.
People don't understand. People do not understand this. Yeah. 175 megabyte hard drive was a big deal back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the fact that you had, I don't want to get into it because we're getting too old now.
Here's one that'll blow your mind. Okay. I bought a black and white laser printer and it cost me $3,800. And I just bought one for my office, and the toner cartridge was more expensive than the printer. It cost like, I don't know, $69 or something like that. Right. I was like, oh my gosh.
So much has changed. Okay, so you were working at a frame shop.
Yeah.
You're selling t-shirts. Yeah. And when you say you're selling t-shirts, is it the way I imagine? You come up with the design, you pay for the printing, and then you're selling your original artwork on a t-shirt? Is that how that works?
Yep, that's how it worked. I went and I had them printed, and I shipped them. I, you know, took them in cases with my, you know, old beater car to wherever they were being sold in gift shops and stuff and apparel stores in Manhattan. But then when I went to work for this other company that we were, you know, shipping all over the United States and stuff like that. And
that company, that $5 million company, they also designed t-shirts?
Yeah. We did all original designs.
I see.
We had a huge business in the Caribbean, so a lot of, you know, resort tees and stuff like that. We also did a lot of things called name drops where you have a design, but then you put like Siesta Key on the bottom of it, or, you know, Tampa Bay, or, you know, you regionalize the design for souvenir shops and whatnot. But then I went to work for another licensed t-shirt company that, you know, did a lot of character art, you know, Disney and Warner Brothers and stuff like that for about a year. And then I was managing about 10 people at that point. And then I got picked up by Old Navy right when they were starting. And went into Old Navy and was one of the first, you know, handful of designers there. Again, very kind of moved from senior designer to creative director, and eventually over a period of 11 years moved up to vice president of graphics, textile design, trend, packaging, and color. And so, and I had, you know, five divisions. I was, you know, managing 65 people. So that's how I really kind of got my stripes. I came up in the fashion industry, retail fashion industry. And during that time, I also got to, you know, one of the things I loved about that job is I got to travel all over the world quarterly. So I would fly to, you know, Tokyo and Berlin and London and Milan and Antwerp and shop for work. So I would, you know.
To spot trends, right?
Yeah, spot trends. Yeah. So that's where my trend eye came from.
Okay, so when you're the VP of graphics, trends, and all the other things that you put in there for Old Navy.
Yeah.
What year is this now?
It was 95, and then I left there in 2006.
Right. That's your 10-year span there, 11-year span.
Yeah.
2006. And how quickly were you able to ascend from being new in the door to being VP?
I was a VP within the first 5 years.
Wow. And what do you attribute that to? Like, why did they pick you of all the people? Because you wound up managing 60-ish people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they pick you to be the guy, and why not the person standing next to you? What characteristics did you have?
Well, I think one of the things that's always worked to my advantage is I'm very left and right brain. I have a I have a head for numbers and strategy, and the other piece of it is people management. You know, that's where the teaching really came in handy, because I had, you know, developed a decent emotional intelligence. So managing people was came easy to me. And I also, you know, built great partnerships within the organization. So essentially my groups were acting as an internal agency to all the other product divisions. So, you know, I think it was I built an acumen for finance and budgeting and, you know, hiring the right people, managing people, you know, being a good negotiator with my business partners, that sort of thing.
So you're basically doing everything that I wish I had done at whatever place in my career, because I aspired one day to create a t-shirt company and go out and sell, but I didn't have your gumption. I didn't have probably even your talent to go out there and sell because I was too stuck in my own brain, like, ugh, this is weird. I don't know. I can't sell. What if they say no? And so I picked a different career path. But you did this, and you seem to have been able to navigate one situation for another and trade up constantly.
Yeah, it worked pretty well. I mean, in the Old Navy t-shirt business, this is just a little fun fact. The Old Navy t-shirt business, graphic t-shirt business, was a $700 million a year business.
Wow.
And we produced, the Old Navy flag tee was the biggest selling t-shirt in history. One year we sold 1.7 million of them or something like that. And we figured it out. It was like 3% of the United States population bought one. That it was so many t-shirts that we had to actually buy cotton futures. So before the cotton was even grown, we had to like buy futures on cotton.
To secure.
To have enough cotton to print the t-shirt. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Holy cow. How does a person go from painting in France and teaching to moving from there to New York and then working for your competitor and then jumping to Old Navy? Is this something that you learned from one of your parents, both your parents? Are they entrepreneurial? Where'd you pick up this idea that you could just do this and to be smart about money and art at the same time?
You know, it was just kind of a natural progression. My dad was a newspaper editor. He owned a series of newspapers and worked for, you know, some big, you know, city papers as an editor. So very artistic. My mom was a preschool teacher. So I didn't have any entrepreneurs in my family to learn that sort of thing from. I think that what I love more than anything about t-shirts is that you get to see your work walking down the street on someone's chest.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and also the jump from fine art. And I, you know, I was a portrait artist. I also did psychological portraiture and all figurative stuff. And so doing illustration for t-shirts became kind of an easy jump. And then t-shirts are a product. And then at that period of time in the early, you know, mid-90s, they were a very hot commodity. And, you know, graphic t-shirts were like the thing for, you know, 5 to 10 years. And so I happened into that industry right at the right time. And Old Navy was, you know, insanely successful. From what I was told, I think they're the most successful retail company in history. They hit $1 billion in sales in under 5 years.
Wow.
And yeah, pretty amazing. So that was a rocket ship ride. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years before the end, they moved all of New York, all of product development, which had been in New York City, they moved it to San Francisco. So I was relocated to San Francisco and had to, you know, set up a life there. And one of the little carrots they dangled in front of me in order to draw me out there was that they were going to take packaging away from the marketing team and they were going to give it to me. Mm-hmm. And so I built a whole new packaging team out there. And at the time, Old Navy's packaging was like really generic. It was almost like generic cigarettes you used to see back in the day were like a white pack. It was all their packaging was like white with the blue Old Navy overall on it. It was just deadly boring. And so they said, you know, you have the freedom to basically redesign all of Old Navy's packaging. And so in about an 18-month period of time, we redesigned just about every piece of packaging in Old Navy and made it artistic. You know, kind of gave individual shops like the girls' denim shop, the men's denim shop, the men's active shop, gave them all personalities and developed kind of very kind of artistic brand identities and looks and feels to that packaging. And so that was a super, super fun project and a lot of fun. And that kind of got me addicted to packaging, which then led to my next jump.
Now, before we get to that, as a person who started where you started from, did you find a moment where you're like, I can't believe I'm doing this? That kind of pinch myself moment where you have a large team that you're managing and you're doing all the important work at a company that's the fastest growing retail company in the world.
Yeah.
And what was that like? What was the environment like in-house?
Well, I'll tell you the one moment where I had to pinch myself.
Okay.
And that's where right after 9/11, you know, air travel was very dicey and we had to go to Europe to go shopping. And so instead of taking, and this was just literally like a week after it happened, instead of taking, you know, regular commercial airline, Mickey Drexler, the CEO, decided that we should take the Learjet. So we took the jet And, you know, six or eight of us piled in the jet, and we had, you know, our two pilots and our own stewardess, and we flew to London and Paris and Milan over a period of about 10 days. And, you know, when you're in a Learjet and you're like being served stuff by like your own personal stewardess, you know, and flying in Milan, and then you go shopping, and then you take the car back to the airplane, and then you get on the plane. It's like the plane leaves when you get on. You know,
right.
It's not like you have to wait for your flight. It's like they're waiting for you. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of those moments where like, okay, I've arrived. This is pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Now, did you do anything to commemorate the moment? Did you take a selfie or did you document
it
in any kind of way?
I wish I had. I had. Yeah.
Because you're balling hard at that moment.
I know. Right? It was sweet.
Dang.
Yeah. Okay. Those were the salad days, baby.
God, good life. Okay. So what is the catalyst for you leaving?
There was a massive reorganization and almost the entire executive team was rolled over to new people. There was a new president of Old Navy came in and just, you know how that goes. They clean house, they bring in their own people. And so I was essentially laid off after 11 years.
Okay.
And then I made my jump over to packaging. So I went to a branding, strategic branding agency in San Francisco that did a whole lot of consumer packaged goods and went in as an executive creative director, had, you know, a much smaller team, like 15 people. But we were working with all sorts of clients, which was great. One of our biggest clients was Safeway. We did all their private label food packaging. We worked with Avery Dennison, Chevron, PetSmart, National Geographic. I mean, Johnson & Johnson. It's like really big brands. And so that's where I really kind of got my strategic branding chops on the job. Because as I said, I'd never been trained in it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I learned the whole business side, the whole retail side, the whole management, the whole creative development side when I was at Old Navy. But then when I came out, it was like, I didn't know dookie about strategic design.
Right.
And so it was a baptism by fire, but it was amazing. And I, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. I absolutely love to learn new things. So I just took to it like a duck to water and just soaked it all in. And every new project I got was a new opportunity to learn something new. Mm-hmm. And so that was great.
Can you tell us what agency this was? I'm curious. I have one in my mind, but I'm not sure it's the one.
Yeah, the agency was named Anthem Worldwide. They were part of Shock Inc. They at one point had about 13 offices around the world. They have since contracted dramatically since I left, actually. Mm. After I left there, I went to Landor Associates, which, you know, people know because it's one of those big branding agencies. And I moved to Cincinnati where I was working with P&G. And, you know, I brought in, you know, PetSmart and National Geographic from San Francisco and, you know, a whole bunch of other new brands, new business development that we did there. And that was awesome.
Man, you've had a pretty amazing career. And I just am trying to imagine some young person listening to this where they studied some kind of art or media arts where it's not directly applicable to the commercial world. And this has got to be very inspiring and also intimidating.
Well, the one thing I would say to those people, and you know, it comes directly from my experience at Old Navy, was that one of the things I had a real hard time doing was finding people who were great t-shirt designers. And so I always had to, because if I got graphic designers, they would know how to do page layout and stuff like that, but they weren't. They weren't as attuned to the artistic side, the illustrational side. So a lot of times I would have to find illustrators and then teach them, you know, typography and color and all that sort of stuff. And so, and a lot of times when I was interviewing those folks, I would advertise for an illustrator. They'd come in, they'd kind of be all starry-eyed because they were in this huge company and, you know, there were a lot of designers there doing really creative things. And, you know, I'd tell them the role I needed to fill, et cetera. And they would say, I had no idea this existed. Like, I had no idea this industry existed. I didn't know that I could leverage my skills as an illustrator in this industry. And that, I think, it happens in a lot of industries. I think that there's kind of an invisible opportunity out there for artistic skills, especially now since, you know, creative and design has been, you know, promoted to the C-suite. The need for design and creativity within almost every industry has just exploded. And so many companies are building in-house teams and leveraging, you know, outside agencies and consultants even more. So it's never been a better time, I think, to be a designer. And I think that, you know, even people who are illustrators or photographers or, you know, animators, particularly animators, there's a lot of opportunity out there in industries that you wouldn't necessarily think were hotbeds.
Yeah. How do you prepare for something like this then? If you're that person listening to this and thinking, how do I get myself in a position where I have the courage to try? Or the skill sets or the mindset, whatever it is.
Lots of times when people are, you know, designers ask me, you know, what they should do or what direction they should go in, you know, a lot of times through their lives, they've been told to follow their passion. And I think passion is carries a lot of weight and almost more weight than it should, because it can kind of freak people out and it's kind of set up this finality to it that can be really intimidating. And so When I coach people, I always tell them to pursue what you're curious about, because curiosity will lead you to places that passion never would have pointed you. And for instance, you know, when I was doing my, you know, printmaking in France and I came back to the United States, I was really curious about this explosion of t-shirts, and I'm like, oh, I can put my artwork on t-shirts and I could try to sell it. And that just created this whole kind of waterfall of events that launched my career. And I think that, you know, if you follow what you're curious about, and if there's a particular industry that you're interested in, you know, maybe you're interested in skateboarding, or you're interested in travel, or, you know, motorcycles, or whatever it is, to really dig in and explore that industry and see what goes into the making of that industry. So, you know, where do they make the product? Who does the advertising for that product? Who does, you know, who does the materials for that product? What do they outsource? Because a lot of companies don't have internal design departments or marketing departments, and there's ways for you to approach and set up, a relationship with a company because you have figured out a way to attach what you're passionate about or what you're curious about to what you do and to a business that will pay you for it.
I love the way that you frame that, shifting the conversation away from passion to curiosity, because it's like follow your curiosity or follow your passion. And the reason why I like that shift is because passion suggests that you know and you're clear, whereas curious is more I'm exploring and still figuring things out. It's a lot less intimidating,
right?
And it means that you don't have to get it right on the first shot.
Yeah.
And people don't know what they're meant to do when they're 18 or 20 years old for the rest of their life. They still are exploring. So follow your curiosity and be open. And if you look at your career path, it's a rather meandering stroll in the creative industry from one thing to the next. So I have to ask you this question then. Were there moments when you were feeling some self-doubt, that can I do this? Should I be doing this? And also, was this tied ever to a financial decision where, man, how am I going to pay the bills? And is taking this job going to lead me down that path? Because that's the other thing. People are oftentimes working against a need to pay bills to sustain themselves. And so it clouds their decision. So I want to first understand that, were you ever in a financial position where, man, if I don't make it like next 2 months, I'm going to be in deep trouble. And then how do you overcome the doubt if you had some?
Yeah. I mean, there definitely were. I mean, when I was laid off from Old Navy, I had worked there long enough that I had a very long severance package and it was great. And, I had bought a house at the Height in San Francisco, which was, you know, a huge weight on top of my head. And when that severance was running out, I had to get something together really quickly. And this opportunity came up. I went to a program that the AIGA puts on. It used to be at Harvard. It was called Business Perspectives for Creative Leaders. They now do it at Yale, I think. And I did that program. And actually ended up sitting right next to the guy who was the founder of the agency that he was selling it to Shock, and he decided that he needed to fill his own shoes. And so we both lived in San Fran. He said, when we get back, come talk to me. And, you know, at the time I had been doing packaging at Old Navy. I liked it, but I wasn't like crazy passionate about packaging. But this agency did a lot of packaging, and I knew I could do it. And I knew that I had a mortgage payment in the next couple months. And so...
keeping it real, Philip is keeping it real. It's like, I knew I could do it, but I also know I have a mortgage. So
yeah,
I'm compelled to do it.
Well, and here's the other part. We did a ton of CPG, consumer packaged goods, but we also did other stuff. Like we did digital, we did media, we did video. Mm-hmm. And those were smaller parts of our business, but they were what I was curious about. You know, how do you expand that skill set? And I was also really, really curious about, you know, the deeper, more intellectual parts of brand strategy. And I knew that working in this agency would offer me that growth. And so that's why I jumped into that. And then when I went to Landor, it was like on a whole nother level, because Landor basically invented that process methodology. Mm-hmm. And after I left Landor, Mauro Porcini had left 3M and was brought in by Indra Nooyi into PepsiCo to start up design inside of PepsiCo. And he had hunted me away from Landor, and I moved back to the East Coast to start up design inside PepsiCo with Mauro and some other really talented people. Mm-hmm. And we built a design center in downtown in Tribeca. And I was managing all of the, I was the VP of Global Snacks, which was all of the, you know, salty snacks that we know and love and are not necessarily good for us, but I love, I'm a snack count. So I was managing, you know, design for Lay's potato chips and Fritos and Doritos and Sun Chips and all those things, which was awesome too. And again, you know, massive reach. Oh, Lay's potato chips is the biggest food brand in the world. It's in 50 countries. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did I ever ask you this question when I interviewed you for my my Brand Muse interview series? What's the most popular flavor of Lay's potato chips in the world?
I think you might have asked me. I just don't remember.
Prawn.
No way.
Yep.
I was going to say sour cream or something.
I know,
prawn.
Right?
Yes. I've never even had prawn potato chips.
You would
chips
say like,
before.
You know, vinegar, salt and vinegar or something like
that. Yeah,
or like
something
that,
really like basic.
Written. Yeah, prawn.
Wow.
Asia.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, fun fact. See, I'm okay, just full
fun
of
fact,
today.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask you a question. So you've been in-house, Old Navy.
Yeah.
And Pepsi.
Yeah.
And you've been out of house in, I forget the name of the agency, but two agencies,
Landor
and the other one, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? What's it like being... internal and external?
I have to say that I, you know, number one, that's being on the other side of the street has always helped me when I've crossed the street. Mm-hmm. Meaning I was in the agency side for a while. And then when I went to PepsiCo, I knew how agencies worked. So I could really work my agencies the way that would benefit me. So having been agency side was really helpful. When you're working in-house, one of the things about it, I need a lot of variety. And so when I was working in the agency world, I had a tremendous amount of variety, everything from, you know, healthcare to technology to, you know, doing branding for kind of jet engines for GE. I mean, just this huge range of things, you know, alcohol, soup, you know, I mean, it just runs the gamut. And so every project that came in was a different project, and it was you'd have to learn an entirely new industry to address that project. And so there was a great amount of variety. When you're in house, you may be dealing with just a single brand. I mean, one of my strategy partners at Anthem, she had worked previously at Clorox, and she was managing Kingsford Charcoal. And she was doing Kingsford Charcoal strategy for like 3 years. I would shoot myself in the head. I mean, I need a lot more variety than that. And so, you know, and that's, to me, if I was to give some advice to people coming out of school, going in-house and working on a single brand for too long is dangerous, because what ends up happening is you end up having a portfolio full of like 19 pages of Eveready batteries or whatever it is working on. And so a lot of times I recommend that people right out of school work for a temp agency. they're, you know, not going to pay as much money because they're, the agency's getting a cut, but the agency's also going to negotiate the best rate they can for them because they want to make money too. And they'll be able to jump around and work at a lot of different types of places, from in-house to agencies, large, small. They'll get a lot of experience. They'll also be able to network. And that's one of the things that, you know, I try to tell, things that I didn't do that I know are incredibly important, you know, meet people, find out who does what, stay in touch with them, get their numbers, because all these people are going to be the people that hire you later, you know, or that you can hire later. So being able to get a lot of variety in your work and in your portfolio at the beginning is really helpful. So you know, if I had to choose, I would say agency side. Now,
right,
the agency side is also, as you know, Chris, incredibly, can be incredibly hectic, can be very short hours.
Right.
And you know what they say is true, which is, you know, when the clients have run out of everything but money, that's when they come to you. So they don't have any ideas, they don't have any more time. They don't have any, they don't have, you know, they have nothing, not a leg to stand on. That's when, you know, they come to the agency and they say, okay, this is how much money we have. What can we get and how fast can we get it? And, you know, we have to show up and do that. So it's a stressful, it, it can be a stressful environment. You know that.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Hey, Ben Burns from the future here. If you don't recognize my voice, you might know me from our YouTube channel as the friendly guy with the big beard. Yep, that's me. Listen, the future's mission is to teach a billion creatives how to make money doing what they love without feeling gross about it. And let's be honest, historically, we creative types are great at producing the work, but not so great at running the business, especially when it comes to things like sales, marketing, and money. I know, personally, I used to struggle with all of those. Now, fortunately for you, though, we have a slew of courses and products designed specifically to help you run your business better. These are tools like the Complete Case Study and the Perfect Proposal. These things are there to help you attract new clients and then wow them with a thorough and professional presentation. Now, you can go even deeper with one of our business courses like Project Management, How to Find Clients, and the Intensive Business Bootcamp. Check out all of our courses and products about running a creative business by visiting thefuture.com/business.
Welcome back to our conversation with Philip Van Dusen.
Now, I want to get us more caught up to current history now.
Sure.
So when is it that you started your own thing? And I also definitely have to talk about YouTube. So I'm going to save that because that's going to be super juicy. And I have a thousand questions to ask you there, I think.
Okay.
Let's get you to current date. So tell me what timeline are we now? Like when?
Sure. This was about
when did you leave
5 years ago. I left PepsiCo 5 years ago. In 2013.
Okay.
And I just burned out. I had a major burnout. I was working, you know, 8-hour weeks. It was a global job.
Wow.
So I was, it was intense. And, you know, as much as PepsiCo has now become a design-centric company, when I was in there, they were not. They were certainly not warm to the idea as much as they would have, you know, we would have liked them to be. So I just burned out. And I came to the point where I just woke up one day and I was like, you know, this is a personal thing, but hey, personal feeds into professional. My dad was in the process of passing away. He was developing dementia and I was kind of watching him disappear in front of my eyes. And I just woke up one day and said, you know, life is too short for this. I'd rather spend the next 3 months with my dad while he still recognizes me than, you know, chasing down some chips project. And so I walked away from the biggest job in my career. And talk about a watershed moment. I mean, that scared the you know what out of me,
right?
Because that was a gravy train, you know. And but I knew that there was going to be something better around the corner. And I knew it was time for me to do something different. I wasn't even sure if I knew what I liked, if I liked what I was doing anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I had to take a break. And I was in the position, you know, having worked as long as I did in all these industries, that financially I was in the position to take about a year off. So I did that.
Okay. I got to ask you, and feel free to disclose whatever you are comfortable with. But when you talk about the gravy train, paint the picture of how hard it was for you to leave in terms of perks, packages, salaries, compensation, whatever it is that you want to describe to us and you feel comfortable talking about. Because you're talking about walking away from the biggest, possibly even the best job in your career so far.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough to do that. And, you know, I don't want to get specific about salary, okay. But, mm-hmm. you know, as a senior level creative person in a Fortune 60 company, you can make really nice money. Mm-hmm. You'll get benefits, you'll get bonuses, you know, you get travel, you get all sorts of stock options and stuff. I mean, it's very sweet when you roll it all together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, walking away from that was a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you take a year off. First of all, you were burnt out. Your dad's health was going poorly, going south.
Yeah.
So you decide, you know, I'm going to just collect myself, figure it out, realign myself with what's important. When is it that then you start your own agency?
Well, the funny thing is I actually started with that strategy partner I was telling you about. I started an accessories company. I kind of went back to my roots. Oh. And I started talking to a bunch of, you know, network connections and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we were talking a lot about like the resurgence of craftsmanship in America. Mm-hmm. and the movement away from mass produced goods and more towards, you know, high levels of workmanship. And so we decided to start an online accessories company that that created a curated collection of some of the best things in those worlds and to offer them up to people. And so we developed our brand from scratch. I mean, we did all the strategy, we did the naming, we did the product development, you know.
What's it called?
It's called what my agency is called because I kept the name.
Oh, okay.
I kept the name. It's mm-hmm. no longer in existence. You could probably okay. find it in the Wayback Machine. But
right.
It was named Verhaal, which mm-hmm. is a Dutch word, V-E-R-H-A-A-L. And it means story. And so it made a lot of sense in terms of the products that we were doing because they – the story of where the product was from and who created it and its provenance was really, really important to us. So, and my family is Dutch. My family came to the United States in 1623. So the entrepreneurial roots of my family go way, way back. And so it being a Dutch word also kind of resonated with me as a Dutch American. Mm-hmm. And so when we closed that down about a year later, I kept the name. And I named my agency that because story mm-hmm. is everything in branding too.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I started, we did this accessories company. And in that period of time, I went from, you know, working at a Fortune 60 company with teams of people to sitting in my home office by myself alone for a year, you know, doing stuff like, you know, photo retouching and product photography and, you know, right. building websites and, you know, figuring out email marketing and MailChimp and all this really super hands-on stuff that I hadn't been doing for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh my gosh, there is so much stuff that I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was this massive kind of wake-up call and also put me again on this major learning curve of getting up to speed on entrepreneurship and digital marketing and, you know, and e-commerce. It, you know, retail in the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized how much I didn't know. And I started to really network really heavily with other entrepreneurial people. I joined some entrepreneurial mastermind communities and just jump-started my learning and built an entirely new network of people. And, you know, subject matter experts and just dove right into it. And we shuttered that accessories company after about a year. And mm-hmm. that's when I decided that I realized that I love building brands. That experience of starting that brand up from scratch, the year off of kind of like taking a breather, doing a lot of informational interviews, trying to figure out, you know, what I liked about what I did, what I didn't like, when I built that brand with my partner, I realized how much I love building brands and also how much I loved the hands-on work of doing strategy and design and stuff like that. So when I started my agency, I put all of that stuff back into it, back into that. And I leveraged all of what I, you know, learned and was doing in digital marketing, but then right. for my own agency.
So there's this gap, right? I think I'm trying to build the timeline in my mind here. 2013, you leave Pepsi, you're burnt out, you take a year off. Mm-hmm. There's this gap. And then you start your accessories company. And mm-hmm. after years, like it morphed into what it's going to be because it's just yeah. figuring things out. So now I think we're 2015, right? Mm-hmm. If we're roughly following along. So you've been doing this now for 3-4 years. What were some of the biggest challenges and how did you overcome them in running your own business? Because it's nice. I can only imagine. I got to be honest with you because I've not worked for somebody for very long. So I don't even know what it means to be in-house. But to have the title VP of snacks and having teams of people where you're like, you can be the high-level idea guy.
Right.
And then have people move. And if you wanted expertise, you just hire it out.
Yep.
Now it's like you are the man. You're the guy invoicing. You're the guy sending emails. You're the guy prospecting. That's a giant seismic shift. Now, luckily, your storied career has all been leading up to this moment.
That's
from you hustling back in the early days, selling T-shirts, right? And learning about product sales, marketing, all the kinds of things, and strategy from mm-hmm. the packaging company. You've learned all this stuff. Now it's time to do it for yourself. And for all the reasons, you're here. But what were some of the biggest challenges year one, aside from what you've already said, which is I needed to learn so much? I mean, how did you onboard your first big client or what were those pivotal moments like?
Yeah, when I built my agency, one of the things I decided to do and one of the things that I noticed, and I wanted to share this, we talked a little bit about it on the interview I had with you, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, big agencies are having a hard time. Lots yeah. of them are contracting. And the client side is either building something in-house and utilizing agencies less, or they are using smaller and smaller agencies because they're fast, they're nimble, and they're cheaper. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Landor, I noticed that P&G was using smaller and smaller agencies and taking off big chunks of business from Landor and giving it to consultancies or partnerships. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I was at PepsiCo, I was on the client side doing the same thing. I would give like a big, meaty, global Cheetos job to like a 6-person agency in Vermont. Something that would have gone to Landor. And so I noticed something on the horizon that there's a rise of the consultant class, like having low overhead, senior level partners, flexibility, being nimble, being able to give a super high quality level product, but do it faster and cheaper than the big brick and mortar agencies was the way the industry was moving. And I decided mm-hmm. to be on the right side of that history. And when I started my own agency, I architected it that way. So I'm the principal. I have probably a dozen close partners who I will bring in and build a team for any particular client, depending on the scale of the team or what expertise I need. All of these people have their own consultancies. They will white label their services under me. Periodically, mm-hmm. I'll white label my services under other people.
Right.
And it works really well that way. You know, if it's never about working the work, it's all about landing the work. If you can land mm-hmm. work, you can mm-hmm. you can find someone to do it. That's why okay. I always say the answer in the agency world is always yes, right? I've heard you say this too. It's like the answer is always yes. It's right. like, do you do like digital animation with 3D spaceships? And it's like, yeah, of course we do that. And then you're yes. like on the phone 2 seconds later, I need a 3D spaceship design.
Right, right.
You know? Right.
Okay, I have so many questions here. So
yeah.
essentially, if I understand it correctly, it's a form of the fluid agency model where you're the principal
yeah.
and you work with a very large network of highly specialized people. Sometimes you're the lead and sometimes you're just following their lead and it, yeah. it works that way, right?
Yeah. Most of the time I'm the lead. I don't really yes. farm myself out that too much because I stay very, very busy with right. my own agency. So I don't really have the bandwidth to do that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if a project is super sweet, like I just had a call with someone, a Canadian partner of mine who has her hands into a new kind of a new industry mm-hmm. That sounds really interesting. And she was saying, you know, if this thing comes down the pike and I land it, will you work it with me? And I said, absolutely. Because it's, right. It's something that I'm passionate and interested in, curious mm-hmm. about, you know, mm-hmm. there's that C word again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so when I was, to answer your question, when I was starting out, I leveraged, obviously I've been in the industry a long time. So yeah. I have a lot of network connections. I have a lot of connections on the client side. And so mm-hmm. I reached out to a lot of people, and, you know, let them know that I was doing my own thing now. The other thing that I did, and this is going to lead into, you know, the YouTube channel too, is I don't like doing sales. I don't like doing cold call. I don't like doing outreach. It's really, I'm very introverted in that way. Mm-hmm. And so as I had learned over the last few years, I was like, content marketing can do this for me. Mm. And so I love writing. I've always loved writing. That comes from my father being a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I certainly have a lot of points of view. And so I started a newsletter and, you know, was putting out insights and resources on entrepreneurship and design inspiration. And that grew very quickly. And after about, 6 months, I started to, you know, I take it back. After I sent it out, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, comes out every 2 weeks, like in 6 weeks, I was already getting people who were contacting me saying, oh, this great newsletter. I see you have your own thing now. I have this project, you know, and that's kind of how it got going. And it's always only snowballed from there since I've gotten into video.
Okay, so let's talk about the jump to video. You started out with a newsletter. Yeah. We preach the same thing, really. It's very difficult to do sales, and the ones that are very good at it are few and far between. And if you love sales, then you're probably selling some jumbo jets or aircraft carriers to somebody, and you're making a lot of money for each sale. The rest of us, normal folk, it's sales is a means than end, but we'd rather not, right? So content marketing, creating something that could be valuable to somebody serving someone else and using that as a magnet to draw people into you, alleviates the burden of you having to knock down doors and do cold calling, which is a really difficult job, right? So you're doing this.
It actually does multiple things. Number one, it draws people to you, so you don't have to mm-hmm. reach out to them.
Yes.
Number two, when they finally do contact you, they already feel like they know you. Mm-hmm. And by doing it, you're establishing yourself as an expert, so they trust you. And so that's like the trifecta, right?
Right.
Doing content. Sorry, I interrupted.
Totally. Very compelling. I'm glad that you pointed that out. So when do you make this jump to YouTube? And I got to ask you about technical geeky things like Talk Shop, but
yeah.
When do you make this jump to YouTube, and why did you do it, and what has it done for you?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing my newsletter. I still do my newsletter. Mm-hmm. And when I realize, you know, I'm trying to be very forward-looking, and the world is going to video. And the more stats I heard, the more I read, the more I saw, the more I experienced on social media. You know, Google was putting out stats like, you know, 85% of web traffic in the next 5 years is going to be video. And, you know, so not being in video is just turning your nose up at one of the most important communication vehicles that there is. You know, you could say the same with audio for podcasts.
Right.
That the self-publishing industry, the ability to put out your own ebook on Amazon and have it printed, you know, individually, all of those are, you know, podcasting, YouTube, self-publishing, those things are like dreams. Like if I had those things in the beginning of my career, I never would have gone down the path I did. I would be a publishing magnate just because I would be publishing all this stuff. And so anyway, so I felt like when I was, when I started my YouTube channel, I wanted to teach again. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to capture everything that I knew. And I wanted to share it with whoever it could benefit. And so it was, to a certain extent, altruistic. I knew that eventually it would come back around and benefit me. It would benefit me in a lot of ways. Number one, it would establish me as an expert in my field, visibly out there to anyone who would search it. It would act as a, you know, a new business lead magnet for my agency. It would help people develop and grow in their careers, which I really wanted to do. I really wanted to share everything that I knew and had learned in my career with other people. And I'm a deep believer in the fact that that sort of stuff comes back as good karma. You know, there are a lot of people in the world, you know, my YouTube subscribers who live in, you know, India or Pakistan or whatever, who can't afford design educations. And, you know, the fact that I'm teaching them the basics of how an agency works or a company works, or how to get promoted, or how to do, you know, ace an interview, or how to do brand strategy so they can offer something more than just a logo, are all giving tools to people to survive. And that I really love that.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember what year this is that you started getting onto YouTube?
What is it, 2019? It was the end of 2016 or mid 2016.
So not very long.
Yeah, two and a half, 3 years.
Yeah. Okay, so I got, so here's some of my geeky questions, and I got to do this in the next couple of minutes here, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you are making this transition to producing video, there's the technical hurdle, but then there's this other hurdle of like, man, do I really want to be on camera? It freaks a lot of people out.
Yeah, it does.
How do you get over this part?
Grit your teeth, you know? Because I mean, if anyone's seen me or seen my channel, they know I'm not a spring chicken. You know, I'm gray.
You and me both,
I have
man.
A gray beard. You know, yeah. When I was going to do my channel, I had just grown this Van Dyke and handlebar mustache that I have, and I was like, I'm going to go on video. People are going to see me. It's like, I'm going to be the old guy. No one's going to want to watch me. And I just thought, you know, either I can shave it all off and kind of fake it and act young, or I can just embrace it and say, I am the gray graphic design strategy wizard, you know, and I'm the Yoda.
Gandalf.
That's and so I'm are. Like, if I do that, I'll never have to change, you know. Right. Eventually, if I did it the other way, I'd have to admit my age, right? So I just embraced it. And, you know, I'm no stranger to be up in front of people. I've managed people forever. I've always, you know, I've pitched huge clients. I've spoken all around the world. You know, it's just like, I'm not, it terrifies me. And actually being in front of a camera terrified me more than anything else. But, you know, you just have to accept your imperfections. And the hard part is what, you know, when the people who have nothing better to do go, oh, you look like Colonel Sanders, or, oh, you look like Steve Jobs. I've literally had maybe 10,000 Steve Jobs comments.
Really?
Yeah, because I always wear a black t-shirt and I have kind of roundish clear glasses. And so people do that. And you just have to get, just have to get by.
Hey, that's not a bad comparison. It's the one, you know, if I'm going to have a comparison. Steve Jobs is not a bad one.
10,001.
You know, this is fantastic.
Yeah. So, so anyway, so, you know, and then there are, you know, days where you're like, oh man, I had like a big piece of lint right on the top of my t-shirt, or I have something in my mustache, you know, and that video is going to live forever. And you're just like, the way I have this motto that just says dare to suck. And it's like, you just gotta put it up there,
like,
because everybody sucks at the beginning. And the only way you can get better is to start. The only way you can get better is to start. And I always tell this story. It's like, if you want to learn tennis, you can read books on tennis. You can watch videos on tennis. You can buy the coolest tennis racket. You can buy great tennis clothes. You know, you can go watch tennis matches. But the thing is, until you get out on the court and start hitting balls all over the place and going over the fence and whatnot, you're not going to learn tennis.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's how I treated video. I spend no time on production value. And I spend all my time on doing really great content in a really short period of time. I try to give more value in 5 to 8 minutes than anybody else does in 25.
Mm. So do you wind up writing the episodes first and then recording it?
Yeah, I do. And that's the only way I can get as much info out as I do. I put my laptop underneath the camera, and I basically kind of read speaking notes. It's kind of like a deck with like notes. So it's extemporaneous, but I have an outline.
Okay, fantastic. And then you wind up, do you do the editing yourself, or you send that to somebody to do?
I did it for the first, I actually just started sending it out like a month ago. Mm-hmm. It just got overwhelming.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you send the video out, they work remotely, you make some notes, and then eventually they figure out your rhythm, they cut in your graphics, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just curious. Well, let's look forward into the future. You're running your branding agency and you're running your YouTube channel. How important are these two components to you and to your future?
Both. YouTube channel?
Like if you have 100% units of energy, how do you divvy these things up between these two endeavors?
I think probably 20% video and content and 80% mm-hmm. agency. I mean, that mm-hmm. in terms of the amount of time that I spend doing it. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I put so much energy into the content is because I see, also see it. I repurpose content too. So I take video transcripts and I write them into articles. I eventually mm-hmm. want mm-hmm. to develop some courses, video courses. I'm going to mm-hmm. write a book. You know, I'm going to take a lot of the content from my videos and put it together in a cohesive book on branding and strategy. And mm-hmm. so I see all of the stuff as I'm creating a library of content that I'm going to be building on and doing things with for a long time, mm-hmm. even after I stop my agency work.
So what you're doing, which we talk about a little bit on our channel, it's all different forms of content marketing. You could take something and you could make micro pieces of content. You need a little bit of cut downs. You could do an audio only version. You could transcribe, like you said, and write a book or... It's just the whole ecosystem of who you are and your life and your philosophy shared with the world very openly, and it's a wonderful resource. So before we say goodbye, like, how do people get in touch with you? If I'm listening to this and I need help with brand strategy and you're the right person, where do they go?
You can go to my website. It's philipvandusen.com. And there's pop-ups there for my newsletter. There's also forms for my newsletter. Subscribe to that. You'll get a mm-hmm. newsletter from me every 2 weeks. I don't spam people. I interact very closely with people on my YouTube channel. So show up there, make some comments. You can always contact me through a contact sheet on my website too. There's new client applications there that I do mm-hmm. coaching. You know, I mm-hmm. outline a lot of my programs and things. So that's the best portal.
Beautiful. Are you most active on one form of social media over another?
I would say YouTube, like, definitely.
YouTube. So you're reading the comments and you're engaging with your audience.
I answer every single comment I get.
Hey, you and me both.
I've answered probably, I don't know, 50,000 100,000.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure they come in. So you guys, you need to know that. And I really applaud you for doing this, for giving away your knowledge for free. And I wish I had more time to talk to you. But this has been a fascinating journey, kind of following along with you in your life. And seeing all these decisions. Now, at some point, somebody's going to listen to this episode. And you guys hit me up with some questions. Maybe we can do a follow-up episode where I can really dig deep. Because I think what makes you really remarkable and just hearing about your story is your ability to just adapt to everything. Whatever fear you're afraid of, and it even seems like you're afraid of anything, and you just go for it. And you're not married or attached to any particular outcome. Like when you make that decision, hey, I don't want to do t-shirts anymore. I'll work for the competition. I'm going to go to Gap. I'm going to go to Landor. I'm going to go to PepsiCo. I'm going to do my own thing just because it feels right at this moment. Yeah. And I love that part about you too, where you said you're a life learner and you're willing to spend money to learn things. And they've consequently led you to job opportunities too when you did that training or when you seek out industry experts and you... This is the life. This is the virtuous cycle that I want for everybody. So if you're listening to this and you're wondering, how the heck do I become like Philip Van Dusen in your own way? Just learn to follow your curiosity and not to be afraid, because wonderful things wait for you on the other side.
Absolutely. Philip,
thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks, Chris. I really appreciate you having me on. It's great to talk to you. This is Philip Van Dusen, and you are listening to The Future.
Thanks so much for joining us in this episode. If you're new to The Future and want to know more about our educational mission, visit thefuture.com. You'll find way more podcast episodes, hundreds of YouTube videos, and a growing collection of online courses and tools covering design and business. Oh, and we spell The Future with no E. The Future Podcast is hosted by Chris Doe and produced by me, Greg Gunn. This episode was edited and mixed by Stuart Schuster with intro music by Adam Sanborn. If you enjoyed this episode, then do us a favor by giving us a rating and a comment on iTunes. It's a big help in getting the Future message out there, and it makes us feel good too. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next time.